Oh, your love belongs to me. La ta 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 ti ti ti. La ta 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 ti ti ti. Ti 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 ti. Ta 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 ti ti ti. Oh, jealousy is a terrible thing. Ti 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 ti. La ta ta ti ti ti. Have you ever had a? Of course, everybody has. You know, no point in asking a question. It's the truth. There isn't anybody alive who had not, at one time or another, secretly in his deep, innermost soul, said, God, I wish I could play the piano. Or something. I mean, you know, but, I mean, this is an age-old problem, huh? Today I was pulling a lot of old junk out of my office, you know, all kinds of stuff piled up. And I'm tossing stuff out of the file cabinets and junk. All of a sudden, I come across this. And there it is. Laying there, pristine. Arrogant. Permanent. Refusing to give up. It's just laying there, see. And I said, my God, there it is. Can't you just see yourself sitting there? You know, with a droopy cigar hanging out of your mouth. Your hands moving, Mike. Like demented talons. Just moving back and forth over that keyboard. The smoke arising. And the crowd watching and listening. Yeah, you're just playing away there, see? This chick sitting in the back there looking at you says, oh, God, that guy can play, man. He's just got them magic hands. And there you are, you know, your fingers moving like there's some spirits are driving them on. No human being can play like that. Yeah, yeah. Room. The people are sitting out there they're just listening. They can't talk yet. They're just listening. They're listening to you. Soft and easy, moving up and down a keyboard like a panther. Just your right hand is unearthly. Yeah, you just hit that ding, ding, ding. Fingers of bourbon on the top of your pie. Without even missing the beat, you take a sip, you know. And the crowd cheers you. Just goes right into the next one, see, without even missing the beat. The crowd is cheering, see. You say, wait, I can play it. You think you heard something, wait, you hear this style. I'm going to play my mean stuff now. Now, at about the second or third measure, there ain't a dry eye in the house. Oh,
My God, how that man could play the blues.
Can't even play them on a key, on an 88-note piano, you know. Just no way. You're lost in your own world. It's like your fingers are attached directly to your soul. That ain't no piano that man's playing. Man, that's a living organism.
George. Yep, that's got to go. Because you know that piece of music there, just listen to that guy play, reminds me of one of the most painful episodes of my entire existence. Oh, man. I mean, I'm serious. When you were a kid, did you, George, ever decide that you were going to take lessons or something like that? You had to learn something. Were you ever pulled in on anything like that? I wonder how many people listening tonight, how many guys, chicks, anybody who were pulled in on that thing one day, you just had the urge that you had to learn something. Well, I was seduced by a thing I heard on the radio. And it got me. Now, how it got me was a very subtle thing. There was a kid about four or five blocks away from our house named Tommy Van Hoos. I remember Tommy Van Hoos. And Tommy Van Hoos could play the piano. But he could really play the piano. He was about 12 years old. This guy could really play. You know, he'd sit down and play the piano. And I don't mean play that kind of stuff that they take when they're learning, you know, like dun, 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 dun. This guy played the piano. He'd sit down and, you know, just lay that stuff out, and it just seemed like magic to me. It used to just really gasp me. There are not many kids that impressed me, but that kid did. And I hardly knew this kid. And any time at school, when, like, we had an auditorium session, Tommy Van Hoos was sitting down and playing the piano for the glee club and that, you know, oh, fantastic. Well, now, there's a period in your life when you go through, when you put that kind of stuff down, you know, kids take a tap dance lesson, oh, come on. But when you begin to see that this guy is emerging as a star, that changes it. And one night, on the radio, there was this program came on. And it was one of these 15-minute shows. You know these 15-minute transcribed shows? You occasionally see these things on television where there's a 15-minute thing telling you ought to buy this this food dicer, you know, or this vegetable squeezer. And this, they go on, and they give you, you know, and they talk about how great it would be to have this vegetable squeezer. And they show the demonstrations. You've seen those 15-minute films once in a while. Way at the end of the day, they're usually after the last Class D movie has gone off, on comes this thing, selling all kinds of cockamamie stuff. Well, they're way down on the dial, and I was building radios at the time. And I had this room that was my room. See, and the room was absolutely filled with all kinds of junk that I was building. I was building radios, and I had built a radio that was a two-band radio. It was supposed to get broadcast and like 49 meters, short wave. See, and it had plug-in coils. And I actually really did. I mean, it really did hear broadcast great on it. It was a super regenerative receiver. And the only problem with the receiver is every time I would tune it, go across the dial,
Every time I'd hit a station, it would regenerate. Now, maybe you don't know what that is, but a regenerative receiver is one that utilizes a certain type of detection that when you hit a station, there is a strong signal beat. In other words, it goes a loud whistle. See, when you come across the station, and then you tune right into the middle of that node to tune this regenerative. It wasn't super regenerative. It was a regenerative receiver. You'd hit that node. You go zero beat it. See, and the signal would come in real great. And then you'd back your regeneration control off. You go we just start to beat a little bit. Pop. Right on the edge of regeneration, and you could hear this signal now. The signal that you've tuned to would come in beautiful, clear, sharp. But there's one thing that would happen with a regenerative receiver. When a regenerative receiver is regenerating, in other words, making that whistle, this is in lay terms, I'm putting it out here tonight, it is also acting as a transmitter. It is literally transmitting on that frequency to which you're tuned. So all around, you're like, you know, for blocks around, people sitting there listening to the radio, or their radio's on, and there's a station on there. When I would tune across that frequency, of course, it would go in their radio. They'd hear this, and it would go whistling right on past. Now, if I sat on a frequency and didn't turn the regeneration control down, therefore cutting out the oscillation, I could just, like, literally jam any frequency for blocks around, and it's radiating from the antenna. See, so, but nevertheless, I'm sitting there listening to my radio. Now, I would listen to the radio, not because I liked the radio, the shows that were on the radio. I must point out that I was not a radio listener as a kid, no way. But I liked the fact that my radio worked. I listened to it because it was working. So one day I got this radio. See, I tuned in, and but I got this signal. See, I'm listening to this guy, and he was on this radio station, which even to this day I remember. It was WLS, which is a big station out in Chicago. It's a real big powerhouse. Speaking of powerhouses, this is WOR, New York. This ain't WLS. This is WOR. And before we go any further, I'll lay one on you here. We've got the House of Chan with us tonight, which is also a big gun in the Chinese food world. And if you've never dropped by the House of Chan, it's very handy, in fact. It's right in the middle of town. It's at 52nd and 7th, which is not too far from Times Square. Right now, pretty close to the theater district, in fact. And if any of you are going to a theater or something coming in town some night, and you want a place where you can get a really good meal, but at the same time, they'll get you out of there in time to make the show, go to the House of Chan. It's very close. It's walking distance to all the theaters. The food is great. And they know about the theater problem. So if you tell them that you're going to make a show, they'll make sure that you get your food in time for it. It's the House of Chan. Excellent Chinese food. They have a bar. They're open 7 days a week, and they're open till midnight. Food is great. The House of Chan. Well, here's a little commercial here. The exciting new Village Supermarket in Islip, Long Island, is now open from Monday through Saturday until midnight. Oh. For a new look in supermarkets, you must see the Village. You'll love the breathtaking early American decor, the wonderful new departments, and best of all, the tremendous variety of quality foods at lowest possible Village prices. And they have an in-store pharmacy where you can have a prescription priced and filled while you mess around over in the frozen food department. It's on Sunrise Highway and Saxon Avenue in Islip, Long Island. Come and bring the whole family to the dawn of a new shopping era. Come to the Village. Open until midnight, Monday through Saturday. That's in Islip. Let's see. What's the address again? It's Sunrise Highway and Saxon Avenue in Islip, Long Island. It's a new supermarket. And, what do they mean by early American decor? somehow the idea of an early American supermarket has its little side issues there. Open until midnight, Monday through Saturday, right? Well, I see they're going to have a big telethon. Let's see, is it a telethon? Yeah, yeah. More than 50,000 children and adults suffer from cerebral palsy. I keep hearing that pronounced cerebral or cerebral. You can help. Join Dennis James, Paul Anka, Steve Lawrence, Edie Gourmet,
and many other top stars on the 22nd annual Greater New York United Cerebral or Cerebral Palsy Telethon. That's Saturday night, starting at 10 p.m. on WOR-TV. That's Channel 9. I repeat, that's Saturday night, starting at 10 p.m. on WOR Television, Channel 9. Channel Whoopi.
In a lot of states, driving on a badly worn tire isn't just dangerous. It's illegal. If the police catch you driving on worn tires, you're in trouble. If the police don't catch you, you may be in even more trouble. You're riding on borrowed time. Tire Industry Safety Council.
Well, speaking of commercials, I got really taken in by one. I'm sitting there with my radio working away. I have to bring you back into this. The mystique of building radios and building electronic equipment, once you're sucked into it, it's almost impossible to ever get it out of your blood. It's a terrible sickness. Do you agree with that, George? It really is. And I'm not talking about building Heath kits. That's not the same thing at all. Building a Heath kit is just like, it's buying a prefab house and putting it together. That's not quite the same as building a house, I could tell you. And this is something else entirely. You see, when you build equipment, when you actually build a radio, or you build a transmitter, or you build something from absolute scratch, and you spend all of your time going up and down into radio parts places, surplus joints and that, and getting the parts that you need for this piece of equipment. And quite often, by the way, working out your own circuits, too. Modifying circuits and so on until you get what you exactly want for yourself. There is no satisfaction that I know of that even comes remotely close to building a piece of equipment from scratch and having it actually work and perform. It's a fantastic feeling. You feel like 20 feet tall. And there's no way to explain it to other people who just say, you got a radio, and that's all there is to it. They don't know that thrill. They don't relate to it. In fact, for those of you guys out there that are into this thing, I'll never forget one of the great achievements I saw a kid do when I was a kid. I was about 16 or 17, something like that. And I was a ham, and a lot of other kids around there were hams. There were four or five of us that were hams. Don't confuse that with CB, by the way. No way. And we were building our own equipment and working around. But this one guy was really into the technical stuff. I mean, he was really into technique. And you know what I mean? It's like some guys get into something so far, man, that they leave everybody else like four or five laps behind. And you may be good at it, but this guy's really into it. and any field you find, this is true. Well, there was this one kid in the neighborhood who was really into this stuff. Johnny Addison's fantastic technique and tremendously into electronic, the techniques and the mathematics of it. That's what it used to really throw us. This guy was really into it. He was about 17. He's working at about the graduate level at this point. And he had his entire basement was a maze of electronic equipment that he had built. See, just for the sheer kick of building it. Well, he got on this kick. He picked up a series of diagrams that were published in the IRE journal. At that time, of course, this is like a 17-year-old kid reading the journals of the American Medical Association or something, he's way ahead of the crowd that's studying Red Cross. He's way ahead of the gang that's taking first aid down at the scout troop. And he's reading the IRE journals. And at that time, of course, they're publishing in the journals, they're publishing all kinds of experimental diagrams of stuff that was way in advance of anything that was available on the market. Well, here's this kid, see, and he a ham, but he's really into the technical stuff. And so we used to spend every Saturday walking up and down in Chicago with South State Street. There were all kinds of radio joints that were just, filled with all kinds of barrels full of surplus radio equipment, all kinds of exotic turntables. I'm talking about stuff that, see, a lot of the manufacturers, when they're making stuff like Zenith or Stuart Warner or RCA or any of these places, when they're making radio equipment, They have all kinds of rejects, stuff that isn't exactly right. In fact, they'll have an entire, often an entire chassis will be completed. And rather than go back and repair it, this thing goes into a junk box. And it's sold out on that market. You may not have known this, but this is a great market, see. So we would go up and down, and every week the stuff would change. You know, one week Central would have all kinds of stuff that that they didn't have the week before, and we would just spend hours looking at this stuff and buying a very exotic a 2 microfarad 2,000-volt condenser, you know, that would be in the middle of a barrel of stuff. And the excitement of finding this stuff, again, is a very special excitement. If I'm talking total gibberish to you, that's too bad. But to the guys who are into this thing, and were into it, and are into it right at this minute, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So don't think I'm talking about the past either. If you go down to Van Cortlandt Street, down around Waverly, down to places down in Lower Broadway, there are thousands of radio places down there right this minute that are teeming with guys who have a dedicated, rapt look in their eyes, and they're picking up a piece of equipment and looking at it, and in their mind is going through these plans, these ideas, what they could do with it. And the guys will buy stuff just because it's great to have it. Never going to use it. It's just great. It's a good piece of gear. They got to have it. So anyway, Johnny is down the basement. I never forget this thing. Now, listen to what he did. If you want to talk about a moment of revelation, for about 3 months, he is working away down in the basement on this fantastic project that he's been reading about in the IRE journals. Now, if you don't know what the IRE journals, that's the Institute of Radio Engineers, which is a very highly technical body of men who are literally engineers. This is not a tinkerer's a manual. It's a magazine that's sent out to these guys, just like the AMA journal is sent to doctors. It's not sent to people that are studying first aid at the Red Cross. This is for serious professionals. So he's getting the IRE journal, which is fantastic for a kid of 16, 17, who is a ham and who has no formal training in this. It was all self-taught. So he's really into it. And he's building this equipment down in the basement. He's really working away on it. And every week we would go down to South State Street to look for parts and stuff. And Johnny's very mysterious about what he's building. We were all building fairly conventional stuff. However, very complex by today's standards. Nothing came, it was no kit form. So if you're building yourself a 2-meter transceiver, and you're building it absolutely from scratch, using all this UHF techniques, you're doing something. Well, that's the kind of stuff we were working on. You know, we were working on this highly complex antenna tuners and modulators and stuff, which by standards of today even is highly technical gear. But Johnny is way out somewhere, see, and he's building this piece of gear, which he is not going to tell us about. He keeps saying, look, he says, I'll let you know when I'm through, see, and he says, if it works, great, you know. So he's working away, and every couple of nights I would go down in the basement. By the way, that's another subject. That there are certain male types, primarily male, and I'm not being anti-feminine in saying this. I just never saw it much among girls, of a male type who is an instinctive builder, who instinctively wants to build stuff, and it's a terrible urge. Some have it, some haven't. Those who have the building urge have it, and they can't get rid of it. The guy may be 100 years old, and he's still thinking, you know, one day I'm really going to build this great thing. And it's always there in your head. I suspect you have it, George, the building thing. Or do you? No way? Well, you knew guys that did. And it's a thing that you can't get rid of. But these guys tend to live a large part of their early lives in the basement. And the basement existence is a special existence. It has nothing to do with the family up above. The family is in another world. They're outsiders. It's a very special kind of in mystique, the basement mystique. And these guys tend to become very pale due to the fact they spend all their time hunched over smoking solder. They often tend to have bad eyes and thick glasses. They have very little interest in sports. They even often don't read much except technical journals. They know the log tables backwards and forwards, and the Q&A, Nilsson and Horna, all these names mean a great deal to them. But you know, upstairs they never heard of that stuff. It's just going on down the basement. So for a long while, I was involved in that strange world. Although I was considered somewhat of an outsider in that world because I did something very almost an un-American thing. I played football. I was playing this. It's a terrible contradiction to him. But anyway, Johnny, he says, now remember, friends, fellow victims, this was a time when it took a lot of money to do any of this stuff. It still does. And to buy this stuff, it was like getting blood right out of your guts. So you'd go down and you'd buy yourself an X-cut Bliley crystal, for example, transmitting crystal. This thing went for about $6-7. Well, that's a lot of money, especially, it's a lot of money right now. Just a little tiny piece of things about the size of a postage stamp, and that was only part of it. You know, everything else that went with that crystal went even more. So it was a problem all the time. But here's Johnny. Every weekend we're down in these radio joints looking for stuff, buying things, and he's looking for very esoteric parts. I mean, very strange pieces of electronic gear that have very little use in the ham world. But he's looking for this stuff. So he's going up and down and talking to guys. And very secretive about what he's doing. And we would ask him once in a while, what the hell are you building, John? I don't want to talk about it. He was a secretive type anyway, because these guys tend to be that way. The engineer type tends to be an introvert for starters. And so that went on for, I'd say roughly about 2 or 3 months, maybe 6 months. I'm not boring you with this, am I? No, this is a strange story, and it to me is part of our time and our world that is rarely recorded in fiction. Rarely does anybody write a short story. You'll never find Philip Roth writing a short story about a kid that's hung on transistors. No way, because he doesn't know about this, and so since he doesn't know about it, he assumes that it doesn't exist. You know, and I would suspect that a large group of the general public is not aware of it. But this is a hang-up. It gets to be almost like alcoholism. As a matter of fact, it becomes so all-encompassing, sucks you into it so deeply, that the true zealots, at a certain point in their life, can think of nothing else. Do you know, I went through a period in my life when I would sit, when I was in school, this was mostly all through high school, and while the class was droning on and they were talking about the Battle of Hastings, they were talking about the civics or something, I would be sitting way in the back there with a license manual stuck in my civics book, and I'm studying the technical questions and answers for, in that case, a Class A amateur license, or a at that point, also a second-class commercial license. Now, this is the kind of stuff that grown-ups way out in left field were studying, but there were 4 or 5 of us in school that had this thing going, and there was no way we could talk to other kids about it because it was so alien to them. It would be like if in the middle of a bunch of kids that are out, playing around and watching Sesame Street, there's one kid who's studying Sanskrit. There's no way for him to talk to those other kids about it. We had no truck with this stuff. The trivial stuff that all the other kids were doing. You know, the other kids are collecting records, and they're hung on music and all that stuff. We were hung on something. We were hearing another drummer, man, and talk about another drummer. It was such a faint, distant drum that even we had trouble hearing it at times. But man, it was pulling us on. So I would sit down there, and I'll tell you another thing about that. That at the time when we were, like, we would draw, we would take, kids would sit around and they would draw stuff. Kids always draw, you know. Other kids would draw a Christmas tree. They'd draw a house. They would draw a sailboat. What do you think I would draw? Well, I'll tell you what I drew. And complete mystification to the rest of the kids. I could draw a complete schematic. Now, if you don't know what a schematic is that strange-looking thing that people see, those little wiggly lines and that, when you see radio equipment put on a paper. It's a schematic diagram, electrical symbols. And I could draw at the age of not more than, I would say, 14, 15, I could draw a complete schematic of a phone transmitter. I'm talking about a transmitter going all the way from the crystal-controlled oscillator through two doubler buffer stages, tripler stages, into a push-pull Class C final, complete with plate modulation, preamplification, modulator drivers, into the antenna tuning circuit, and not only draw this complete diagram, but also put the values of the various components involved. Not numerical values, but electrical values. And I used to sit there and I'd draw this complete schematic, beautiful schematic. And the kids are looking, what the hell is this? You know, all the other guys are drawing houses and trees and boats. I'm drawing a schematic. Well, I was not alone. There were about four or five of the rest of us who were really into that stuff. And even to this day, I read schematics the way most other people read the Queen's phone book. And so that's the truth. So this mysterious thing that Anderson is working on, Johnny. See, we'd go down to each other's basements. Schwartz was one of them. You know, I'd go down to Schwartz's basement. We're working on something. We would always put up each other's antennas and all that kind of stuff, and we would work on each other's equipment, trying to. It was always kind of a joint operation. See, well, Anderson was the loner. He was always building stuff that was his own business, and he even rarely, even after he got it going and was using this stuff, he rarely had anything to say. In fact, he was the first guy I ever knew, and at the age of about 16, who built a complete hi-fi amplifier driver, pre-amplification with about four or five inputs in. This is before nobody, it wasn't being sold. He built this complete series of amplifiers, hi-fi stuff, complete with a couple of Jensen speakers that it took him like blood out of a turnip to buy. And he had a fantastic sound system when, everybody else used to think a K-part was a great thing. This guy really was doing it. And the word high fidelity was totally unknown. He was doing this stuff. See, but this was all working down in his basement, and it was mysterious. But he really laid a biggie on us. A real biggie. And to me, it was a historical moment. And it was historical in more ways than one. He had been working for about five, six months on this piece of gear, which whenever we came over, by the way, was always at the far end of his workbench, covered up with a piece of cloth. Never mentioned it. And when you'd ask him about it, he'd say, I'm just messing around. Very enigmatic guy. Just messing around. Until one Saturday night, very interesting evening, and it changed a lot of us that night. He called up Schwartz and said, asked Schwartz if Schwartz wanted to come over that night. Schwartz said, what for? Because this is very unlike this guy. He was never the kind of guy that asked you to come over. You just went over there, and if he was there, you hung around with him for a while. There's always one guy like that, and he just never cared whether you came or went. That was all. And if you hung around for a while, then finally you just drift out, and that's it. But he never came to your place. He never called you. No way. Well, Anderson called Schwartz. And 5 minutes later, Schwartz calls me. He says, hey, you won't guess what happened. I said, what, Schwartz? He says, Anderson called up. And I says, yeah, so? He says, but he called up and asked me if I wanted to come over tonight. Well, of course, immediately I says, geez, what's up? I'm afraid a guy's sick or something, I says, what do you mean? Schwartz, you mean he asked me to come over? He says, yeah, come over. He says, he wants me to come over. And he said that if I wanted to call you, to ask you over. See, so I said, come over. What's up? Is he going to have a party or something? Because it was so formal, see. Because we just weren't like that. And he says, well, Says to come on over tonight. Wants to come over, he says, about 8:30. That's about 8:30, and it's really that for me. Come over about 8:30. So I said, sure, you know, a very mysterious thing. So Schwartz and I, and I brought along Flick, who was my close buddy at the time. Schwartz and I and Flick went over to Anderson's house. Now, Anderson lived so completely in the basement that you didn't go upstairs in the house, you know, knock on the door or ring the doorbell and say, is Johnny in? No, you just automatically went into the basement door. See, that's where he lived. So we go up to the basement door. It's about 8:15, something like that. And Schwartz just, you know, bangs on the door. And I, hey, Johnny! You know, we didn't go through the doorbell ringing. And you hear a muffled, come on out, you know, down there. So we open the door, go down the basement immediately. And there is Johnny down there with all his equipment. He's down by his workbench. He's got all his stuff. He says, now look, he says, you guys. He says, now, I don't want you to touch nothing. Don't touch anything. He said, just do me a favor. Don't touch anything. Now, remember, all of us were into electronics. There was not a single layman in the crowd. And, in fact, each one of us was a licensed ham. And we still, you know, I still am. So we were all pretty hip to electronic stuff. But here we are. You know, he says, don't touch anything. So with that, it's about 20 after 8, and he keeps looking at his watch. See, he says, well, it's about just about time. And Schwartz says, what are you going to do? What do you mean, just about time? He says, well, just wait. I want to show you something. He takes off the cloth now from the top of this thing, and it was a great big chassis. Now, listen to this, George. It's a tremendous chassis he's got, and it's a big one. You know, a chassis is the metal base upon which things are built, and it's a heavy cadmium-plated chassis about 3 inches high. It was at least 25 inches deep, went back. And it was about, I'd say, 28 inches across. Tremendous chassis. And it's just literally covered with enormous power supply in the back, a great big power transformer. He's got high-voltage condensers. He's got about 37 tubes with tube shields on them and all this. And he's got a couple of brackets built up. It's really a wild-looking piece of gear. But in the middle of it all, in the middle of all this stuff, he has two metal pieces of aluminum that were built like an angle that came up, and right in the middle of where these, like a triangle, it stood up like a triangle, right in the middle of that triangle, what would be the top of the triangle, was a tube socket, and the tube socket had been brazed out of this thing, and a lot of wires, cables going down into the chassis, and in the tube socket was a tube, a tiny cathode ray tube. Now, a cathode ray tube was a very expensive piece of gear. And this was a one-inch cathode ray tube, a one-inch tube. And it was extending outward. And Johnny turns this equipment on. He says, okay, so I'm going to let it warm up. Don't touch anything. Had about 45 controls sticking out of the front with knobs on it. And the thing hums, and it starts to light up, and you could just feel the heat coming out. This thing was dissipating plenty of heat. And at that, the cathode ray tube started to warm up, and it got, it's green, you see. It's a green cathode ray tube, and there's a green signal on it, just green. And as it began to warm up, a small dark square appeared in the center of it. Not more than, I would say, probably an inch by 3/4 of an inch. It was a rectangle, a little dark rectangle began to appear, and this thing is warming up, and I could not believe what I was seeing. It was unbelievable. In this little dark square, there were some letters that came on that cathode ray tube and said, WBKB. It's fantastic. And we're all standing there looking at this thing, astounded, when all of a sudden, without any warning, that little black thing with Johnny's not touching it, it disappears, and on comes a tiny face. It's a face. It's green, but it's absolutely crystal clear, and it's looking right out at us. And the face said, good evening, experimenters. It is time for a one-hour experimental broadcast of WBKB television to experimenters who are able to receive this signal. We will now begin a series of transmission experiments involving vertical and horizontal lines and color shadings. We will also transmit a short film. We would request any of you who are watching this and who have any transmission suggestions or reports to give us a call at this number, and we will collate the results of tonight's transmission experiment. And on came a phone number. Johnny Anderson had built the first television set I ever saw in my life. Fantastic. And he was picking up the experimental transmissions of WBKB in Chicago, which was the Balaban and Katz station. BKB, Balaban and Katz. Balaban and Katz Brothers is what it stood for. And on came a film. I couldn't believe it. And you know, the three of us, you know, me and Flick and Schwartz, we stood there with our mouths hanging open. And Johnny is very cool. He's working away there. He's operating this equipment. You know, he's tooling around with the various controls, and he's varying the intensity and so on. He's absolutely cool. And I said to him, I had to say it. I says, "What is it?" "It's television." I said, "How long have you been doing this?" "So I've been monitoring these signals now for about a month, maybe 6 weeks. They come on every Saturday night." "They're doing that now? It's right by now?" He said, "Yeah. In fact, I'm going to call him." He says, "I report every Saturday night. I call in. I tell him how I'm receiving the signal." Great Scott. At that point, I realized there's a world out there that hardly any of us can understand, but a few guys are already fooling around with it. How's that for a historical moment? This is WOR New York. You stay tuned for Lester Smith and the news.
This is the news in detail on the hour from the WOR newsroom. The federal government got its man today on a tax charge. Reputed big-time underworld leader Agnello Della Croce was convicted by a Manhattan federal court jury of evading $68,000 in federal income taxes in 1968. The prosecution accused Della Croce of getting by the taxes through hidden stock deals. And the government said he was one of the most powerful organized crime bosses in New York State, the underboss of the reputed boss of all bosses, Carlo Gambino. Also convicted with Della Croce were Michael Catalano of Manhattan and Martin Goldman of North Hills, New Jersey. They were found guilty of conspiracy in the tax evasion case. Three men have been indicted for allegedly swindling hundreds of gypsy cab drivers out of $300,000 in insurance premiums and the ownership of their taxi cabs. Brooklyn District Attorney Eugene Gold said that the three men organized a company called Early Bird Cars and then passed the word to gypsy cab drivers that they could get cheaper fleet insurance rates than normally available. But, said Gold, the men talked cab owners into turning over their cab titles to Early Bird while selling the owners non-existent liability insurance coverage for an initial payment of $250 plus $10 to $15 a month. Those indicted on 47 counts were identified as Philippe Michel, 25, Gerard Perez, 22, and 40-year-old Jacques Bourand. Only Michel has been arrested. Gold said that Perez and Bourand are believed to have fled the country. The verbal stamp of rejection today in a Washington courtroom where two Watergate burglary and wiretap conspiracy defendants are still on trial. Defendant James McCord wanted to build his defense around an argument that he had waged political espionage against the Democrats in order to protect President Nixon and other top Republicans from demonstrations during last year's campaigning. United States District Judge John Sirica said that argument was not acceptable, and after sending the jury out of the courtroom, Judge Sirica told McCord and his lawyer, "I happen to be a Republican, but any decent American, Republican or Democrat, deplores this kind of conduct. And it doesn't take a whole lot of common sense to come to the conclusion that this kind of defense were presented to a jury. I just think it would be ridiculous." Tomorrow, in the rotunda of the Capitol building,